and we realised today that we're competing with fireworks, so thanks for tuning us. You can, if you want to tweet about this debate, please use the hashtag WDUSecularism. You can also tweet us questions if you don't really like standing up but still want to ask a question, do that, and Patrick will tell me and I'll read it out. I'm going to introduce the speakers. First, on proposition, we have Dr. Stephen Patel. He is an assistant professor in the Politics and International Studies Department here at Warwick. He studied politics in Plymouth and did a year abroad in Prague. And then he got his Master of Arts in Comparative Politics in York. And in 2003, he finished his PhD in Warwick, after which he taught at the University of Birmingham. And he's also the co-executive editor and the founder of the journal British Politics. And then our second speaker in proposition tonight is Nazir Afzal. He was the chief crown prosecutor in the northwest of England and also the director in London. He has campaigned on a range of issues, including violence against women and girls, child sexual abuse, and honour-based violence. He was also involved in the case of the Rochdale grooming gang and many others, and kind of changed the landscape of child protection in England. And now he gives expert perspectives on many justice issues, including radicalisation. And he got lots of honorary awards and doctors, including an Order of the British Empire, the UK Government's Justice Award, and the Crown Prosecution Service's Civil Servant of the Year. Our first speaker in opposition tonight will be Bishop Dr. Christopher Coxworth. He's the Bishop of Coventry. He was the Principal of Riding Hall in Cambridge. And he has published widely in the area of Christian theology. He's a member of the House of Lords since 2013, and his special areas of interest are education, the ethics of the beginning and the end of life, and foreign affairs. And he's involved in a number of charities, but he's also the chair of the Interreligious Platform for Article 18, which is a loose network of religious leaders and representatives committed to combating religious persecution and advancing the freedom of religion. And then our second speaker in opposition tonight is Abdullah Al-Andalusi. He is a public speaker, debater, lecturer on Islam and Muslim affairs. He's very involved in the Muslim community, researching, writing, and talking about Islamic revivalism, theology, philosophy, physical sciences, humanities, and political philosophy. And in 2009, he co-founded the public discussion forum, the Muslim Space Initiative, which promotes open dialogue and critical debate between thinkers, academics, politicians, and public speakers of all backgrounds. We're extremely excited to have such a great panel tonight. And then without further ado, I'll ask Dr. Stephen Patel to open the debate for tonight. Thank you.
Hello, good evening. Thanks for coming. Can you put this on? Okay, I'll try.
Great, thank you.
Yeah,
is it working?
Is it on?
Yeah.
Right, hello. Okay, well, I'll start again. Thanks for coming on a dreary, wet evening in Coventry when you've got much more serviceable things to be getting on with than coming here, but so thanks for that. I'm going to make three main arguments in respect of the proposition. The first of these is that the idea of having a formal relationship between religion and the state is an anachronism that has no place whatsoever in a modern, multicultural, multi-faith and no-faith society such as the one in which we live. It's essentially undemocratic and it's wrong, and we don't need it on those grounds. Secondly, which is where it's going to start to get slightly problematic, because I am unfortunately going to use some statistics and it may get quite boring, but I like facts and evidence, and statistics are quite good for that, so I'm going to use a few. I'm going to argue that, secondly, religion has nothing unique to offer in terms of having a relationship with the state. And then thirdly, finally, I'm going to argue that the opposite side of this, I suppose, religion actually can have quite adverse negative consequences, particularly when it becomes associated with the state. But the first point really is that these debates tend to be quite boring and pointless, because what usually happens is people don't come to these debates for a debate, right? You don't come here because you're kind of on the fence and you really want to work out which side it's on. Most people in this room, if not everybody, will already have a position on this particular point of view. And so what you really come here for is the kind of entertainment value, which is fine. And you want to see your side win and come out with some witticism or devastating response to the other team and all the rest of it, right? And I'm not, by the way, going to demur from that. I'm going to stick with the stuff I've got to tell you, regardless of everything else. But I am just going to open by appealing to the other side of this. So all the people who are in favour of secularism, that's fine, right? You know, we're on the same team. I'm talking to the others now, right? I'll make you a deal, okay, as a secularist. You can have a state religion. You can have a close relationship between religion and the state, right? But you don't get to pick which one. So we'll take all the religions that have ever existed, about a million or so, and we'll put them all on a hat, and we'll pick one at random, right? And that's the one you're going to get, and you're going to be stuck with. So we're going to have the Mayan religion, we're going to have the Greeks and the Romans, we're going to have Christianity, Hinduism, Sikhism, Buddhism, Judaism, Islam, we're going to have Scientology in there as well, right? And then we're going to pick one, and all of a sudden the idea of having a state religion ain't looking so good, is it? And of course the reason why it doesn't start looking so good when you think about it like this is precisely because they're going to have a slight sense of worry that your religion might not be as well looked after under these other religions as it might be if it was your religion in charge. So, this brings me to my first real substantive point, which is that we shouldn't have a close relationship between the state and religion because it's anachronistic, right? And in this country, we're not. I don't know what the people on the other side are going to say, but this is one of the kinds of arguments you get, that Britain is some kind of Christian country, right? And so we need to therefore have Christianity as the state religion, and that's fine. We're not a Christian country, okay? Secularisation is a fact. It has been in train, certainly since the Second World War, arguably before then. That's a bit ropey, but certainly since 1945. Here comes some of the statistics. In the 2001 census, for example, 72% of adults in the UK said that they were or identified themselves as being Christian. By 2011, this had gone down to 59%. The proportion of people saying that they had no religion had gone up from 15% to 25% over the same period. A study by British Social Attitudes in 2013 found for the first time that the number of people, and these things go up and down depending on the labels that people want to use and attach to themselves, people declaring themselves as having no religion was a majority for the first time at 50.4%. Britain is not a Christian country. Most Christians themselves also regard themselves as being Christian in a sort of nominal sense, not necessarily because they're, in inverted commas, really Christian. There was a survey of self-identified Christians from the 2001 survey, right? So only people who call themselves Christian in that survey were asked these questions. And of those self-identifying Christians, just 28% said that they were Christian because they actually believed in the teachings of Christianity, right? The vast majority, 72%, were Christian because they were raised Christian or they had some kind of vague nominal sense that they were Church of England or whatever it was, right? So even the majority of Christians in this country don't really consider themselves to be Christians in a kind of deep-rooted believing sense. I'm rapidly running out of time. That was argument number one. Argument number two. Religion has nothing particularly unique to offer. One argument that you normally find on this side of things is that religion is good for volunteering and charitable donations and all of that kind of stuff, right? Christians and religious people are just good people and they do good things and therefore this should be promoted. And it's true, right? Most of the research on this takes place in the United States, and it is true that the more religious people tend to give more to charity, tend to spend more of their time volunteering, all of these things, right? It is true. However, when you dig into the evidence, it's not quite as it appears because, again, the vast majority, 73% of all the charitable donations by religious people in the United States went to religious charities or to their own place of worship, which was designated as a charity, right? So it's not the kind of unabashed altruism that you're sometimes led to believe, right? Religious people give more and they volunteer more, but they do it for religious causes. One final thing on this point, studies from the UK, we need more of them, is the answer. But the latest evidence from the Department of Communities and Local Government, this is in 2010, was the last time they bothered to look, found this was looking at civic engagement and volunteering and participation in local communities, right? Found that 34% of Christians had taken part in civic engagement during the time period of the study. Numbers of people, percentage from no religion, was 37%. So there's no real difference between the two. There's nothing special about religion in this particular sense. I've got 1 minute remaining. Right, the bad things about religion, okay? Very quickly, I did a study, you can all go and read this, into state religion and the negative effects of state religion. I'm just going to reel through the statistics. Right, this is what I found. Countries with a state religion, a formal relationship, right? 27% fewer political rights. They had 37% lower levels of civil liberties. They had 41% higher levels of social regulation of religion. This is just people regulating religion and constraining religion themselves informally. And 68% higher levels of religious persecution. Okay? A secular state, this is my concluding statement, a secular state is the best and the only form of ensuring freedom and equality for all its citizens. And if you care about religious freedom, you should want this for yourself too. That's it. I'm done. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mattel. And I would invite Bishop Christopher to open the case for the opposition side.
Well, may I echo Dr. Kettle's thanks to you for being here, and may I say thank you to Dr. Kettle for his opening remarks. I guess what I want to say is that, well, it's certainly not my job to defend every configuration of relationship between state and religion, and I'm sure we could find a whole lot of agreement on certain configurations that are extremely unhelpful. But I do think it's the job of those who are proposing and perhaps voting on the motion to argue that no configuration works, that there is not the possibility of some sort of configuration between state and religion that could indeed be a helpful one. And I think it's also necessary to support the motion to argue that religion, that all of those, to argue that the state is a rather one-level thing. It seems to me the state is a many-leveled thing, involving national and local government and involving all sorts of institutions and dimensions of life. And I just think it's impossible to extricate religion from all of those dimensions. We might say we will extricate a particular religion or a particular religious organization, but to seek to extricate religion per se, I think, is an unrealistic proposal. Seems to me that the motion, which is quite a radical motion, that this House would completely separate state and religion, I feel that has it's working with a rather unhelpful, unrealistic, and indeed old-fashioned concept of the state, which is working with a very radical secular model. And it was a project in the 20th century and the 18th century in other countries and so on to try to attempt a radical separation of state and religion. I don't think that's where we are now in this country. I think the state recognizes that it needs to be working with all sorts of mediating bodies, institutions, charitable activity and all sorts of organizations, including faith organizations. And there are all sorts of interesting ways that's happening. There was a question actually in the House of Lords today, which was a rather inflammatory question about Islam. And there was a riposte actually by a Church of England bishop saying, referring to something called the Near Neighbours Scheme, which is an attempt by the Church of England to try to foster better relationships between faith communities. That is a government-sponsored initiative because the government has recognised that it needs people who understand the way faith communities work to be involved in that. More locally, we have all sorts of examples, including in Coventry and Leamington, not far from here, providing shelter for those who are without anywhere to live. And that's an interesting example that is not funded by the local government, apart from a small grant. We're able to do it, mobilising the churches and also other faith communities. And we managed to do it for a very small amount of money and a huge amount of volunteer work. And I think Dr. Kettle's absolutely right that it's not entirely, that it's not only religious people who volunteer. I'm not sure it's fair to accept, though, that there are sinister motivations. I think there can be sinister motivations, and I think we all need to be very discerning about the motivations that religious people operate with. But in my experience observing religions across the board, the deep compassion that arises within people, I think that is the fundamental motivating factor. The other point I'd like to make is that the proposition seems to me to be working with a rather outdated view of religion. That is assuming that religion is on the way out. Yes, there has been a serious decline in Christian conscious Christian affiliation in this country, and yet there has been a massive increase in many ways of religious life in the life of the nation through new communities coming into the nation, and to try to say that actually we need to have this absolute line between religious identity and religious activity and state activity, I just don't think is workable. I think Dr. Kettle's right to point to examples in the world where there's an unhelpful relationship between state and religion, and I think in this country, in the past, there has been at times an unhelpful relationship. But I think we have to try to look at the situation today, and we have to consider whether the involvement of religion, that is not only the Church of England, but I recognise the Church of England does have a particular part to play in the life of the nation. But I think we have to ask, even with that particular role of the Church of England, are we using that responsibly? Are we using it just as a way to promote our own interests, or are we using it as a way to serve the country and provide a space and a voice for other members of religious faiths? It seems to me we do have a very interesting settlement in the UK which has evolved, and I'm not arguing against further evolution, but it has evolved as a particular settlement in which there is a peaceable relationship between church and state, between faith and state, in such a way that religious life is woven into the fabric of society, woven into the fabric of the state, in a way that seeks to serve the common good. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christopher.
Ms. Yadzal.
Thank you very much. I don't know how this works, but I'll do my best. Good evening to you all. Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm delighted to be here in the best university in the country. I'm sure you want to hear that. I am pro-chancellor of Brunel University, which is the second best university in the country. And I'm not a theologian, I'm not an academic, I'm not a public speaker on Islamic issues, but I'm very proud of my religion. I'm a Muslim too. I'm very proud of it, and I'm very proud of what it achieves in this country and around the world. But that's not the point. The point of our debate this evening is whether or not it should be involved in government. It should be involved at local level, national level, international level. And my view is, and I ask you to consider this, whether you think so too. We can all give several examples of countries where religion is playing a far too great a role and you see so much mischief being developed. We're not saying that at all. I mean, I can think of a land far, far, far away where the force was the religion and the dark side came along, and as a result, you had three absolutely awful prequels. You know, it is something that happens. It's all over the place. And my point is that it's not about my identity. My identity isn't my religion. My religion doesn't define me. It refines me. It makes me a better person. The morality that the bishop was talking about, absolutely key. We all ought to be moral. We all ought to be thinking about what's right and what's wrong and using that in our day-to-day life. But it shouldn't be the reason why we take decisions. And that, to my mind, is where the line needs to be drawn here. Now, when you tweeted this evening, you said I was the first Muslim chief prosecutor. I've got a problem with that. Yes, I am the first, and I'm the only one, as it stands. But I'm also, I said, pro-chancellor. I'm also a legal advisor to EastEnders. Nobody ever calls me a Muslim legal advisor to EastEnders or the Muslim pro-chancellor. But I am, suddenly, when I'm in a position of making decisions and influencing life, suddenly I'm Muslim. Suddenly my faith becomes important to people. Not to me, but it becomes important to people. And that leads, sadly, to people questioning your decision-making, whether or not it's had an impact on the things that you do and the things you say. So you mentioned the Rochdale grooming gang. Was that because all the perpetrators were 9 Muslims? I prosecuted Stuart Hall, Max Clifford, Rolf Harris, you know, the murderers of 2 Manchester police officers. They were all Christians. But for some reason, people always go back to Rochdale or Rotherham or anything that involves Muslims, as if somehow my involvement in those cases was more important. It wasn't. Of course it wasn't. You know, I've spent a career, 25 years, fighting for vulnerable people in all sorts of spheres. And that's absolutely what it's about. The faith shouldn't be what's there, but the faith seems to always come to the front when it comes to me or anybody else. And of course, you know, the far right, you know, I was hoping to crowdsource this evening's event, and I got several tweets and messages, including one from the British First, which called me the C word, exclamation mark. I can't use that in this presentation, but the point is that the far right don't like me. They don't like me. After Rochdale, having made the decisions that were right, bringing people to justice and saving and protecting 47 young girls, I ended up getting 17,000 emails and letters sent to me. I got letters called, I was born in Birmingham, ladies and gentlemen, 17,000 letters and emails calling for me to be sacked and deported. Now, I come from Birmingham, I don't want to go back there. Constantly they had a go at me. Why? Because I damaged their narrative. Their narrative was that all minorities, all Muslims, all whatever are the same. And yet I was the one that brought in justice. So suddenly I damaged their narrative. We can't have that. Let's have a go at him. You know? My point is that absolutely government, you know, Muslims and Christians and whatever faith you may be, or if you have no faith, you are entitled to your opinion and your beliefs. You know, Americans have forgotten. I've been watching the debates, I'm sure you have too. The Americans have forgotten. The Constitution was specifically written to write God out. Because they said, if you write God in, you're writing people out. Man and woman suddenly become less important. You know, when Jefferson was talking about, when Trump talks about a wall that surrounds the United States, keeping the pesky Canadians and Mexicans out, he forgets that Jefferson talked about a wall between church and state. Why were they thinking that way? They were thinking that way because it's absolutely key and important that we focus on the decisions. We take account of all, and the bishop's absolutely right. There's no reason why we shouldn't be listening to the church or whoever and finding out what they have to say on a particular subject. But it shouldn't be them that are involved in decision-making. It should be those you democratically elect, wherever level. criticism at Rotherham when 1,400 girls were abused. You've probably read the reports on that. Their criticism there was that the authorities did nothing because they were concerned about religious discrimination. They were concerned that they would be accused of being racist in some way, shape, or form. Children suffered because of those concerns. That's what I mean about the decision-making being impacted by people's faith and by people's perception of people's faith. And you can't have that. You know, absolutely a fantastic place for the bishop and for anybody else that has a faith to be involved in. I'm gladdened, for example, by the church at the moment and the way it's talking about social justice. Absolutely important they talk about social justice, because if nobody else will, they ought to. But at the end of the day, the decisions should be taken by those people that you've elected to make those decisions on your behalf. And that is where the line needs to be drawn. And, you know, if we don't do that, we will lead ourselves down the dark side. Well, as a proponent said a moment ago, Stephen said a moment ago, you will have a religion that you don't want in charge, then what are you going to do? You know, keep them out. Involve them in everything that you want. Involve them in decision-making, but don't make them part of the decision-making, because there will be some issue then and perception that decision wasn't made on professional grounds. I was responsible for the prosecution of 1 million cases during my career. 1 million cases. I never let my background, my faith, become involved in anything I decided upon. And that's why those decisions were credible and stood up. If suddenly people said to me, oh, is it because the Prophet Muhammad said this or Jesus said that, that's why, then you can rest assured that there will be criticism, and quite rightly criticism, about the decisions that one takes. It's really important to remember that Jesus, Moses, the Prophet, all stood up for the oppressed. Absolutely. And we should remind ourselves that we should be standing up for the 1% rather than the 99%. That's Tristram Hunt for you. That should be standing up for the 99% against the 1% on a regular basis. We should be doing that all the time. And they should remind us of that. But at the end of the day, decisions should be taken by those people that you've elected. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Azal, and now the second opposition speaker, Abdullah Al-Aziz.
Greetings, in the name of God, the most gracious, most merciful. It's a pleasure to be here in Warwick University. Thank you for inviting me. I noticed that it is Guy Fawkes Night. I was going to buy fireworks and participate in Guy Fawkes Night celebration, but I was worried that the Daily Mail would report that a Muslim has been caught buying explosives to set off on the anniversary of an attempted terror attack. Now, the title today is not should religion be formally disestablished from state, or that should a state be secular or not. Actually, the title is should religion be completely separated from state. We have to pay attention to that nuance. It's very important. Now, the issue of the Rotherham rape gangs, I think, was more the issue of racism, not religion per se. Unfortunately, it's newspapers, which are not part of the state, which always mention the religion of the perpetrator, coincidentally if they happen to be Muslim, but not if they don't. But I think there's something that we all eludes us here. Every government, every state has laws. These laws set right from wrong and what can be regulated. And these right from wrong laws are based on something that is not physical, metaphysical, i.e. values and morals. Where do these values and morals come from? Now, people seem to think that religion just refers to spiritual beliefs or the main common Abrahamic faith. No, religion can mean any belief system or worldview based on this metaphysical conception. Even if you're a Confucian, you don't need to believe in God or believe in spirituality per se, but Confucius was a teacher of morality, and he was, you could say, more materially, more material in his construction of argument. So every government is based on a religion of some kind, whether it be Christianity or Islam or secular humanism or what have you. But I would say that if you remove religion from state, you turn the state into a religion. In the modern times, with the idea of fascism is the idea that the state is actually the most primary concern above all other things. That loyalty to the state should be first above loyalty to anything else. And what we see currently in a state which is becoming increasingly secular, this state, we see the government talking about British values. defining British values, I might ask, without consulting any of us, and then requiring that everyone must conform to these British values, or you deem to be unpatriotic or not deserving to be from here. What was this ecumenical council deciding what it means to be part of a group? Well, it sounds pretty much like the worst we hear from the medieval times. And this is the problem. We see that secular states, if you look at throughout the world, actually, unfortunately, control religion more than they protect it. If you go to Egypt, China, Syria, yes, Bashar al-Assad, Syria, secular state, Tunisia, all the most worst states on the world, if you look at the index of rights, are also happen to be secular. Yes, the top states are secular, but also the worst states are also secular states. States where the religious institutions are controlled by government. Recently, the British government wants to unveil its funding to fund specific Muslim organizations to dictate a brand of Islam which they approve of, and they want to silence people who speak about a brand of Islam they disapprove of. All this in a secular state. So now a secular state is dictating to us Muslims what is acceptable theology and what is not acceptable theology. And this is what you get in an increasingly secular state. The Church of England, being the basis of this country, yes, you know, there are people who are of other faiths, including myself, who are not Church of England. However, because they came from an ecumenical tradition, they've been the main defenders of minorities, preventing them from being tampered by with interference from this secular government. And this is, I think, an interesting quirk of the UK and the US, both states which were set up with a very strong component of religion. And while Edmund Burke was talking about the insanity of the ultra-secular radical enlightenment that was occurring in France, which led to massacres and killings, including good scientists like Lavoisier was killed by secularists. He talked about Britain has a great balance. It doesn't go one extreme or the other, but it maintains an extreme where all stakeholders are present in government. You see, what a state does, if it's not restricted by morality, this is really what I'm talking about, is that it will then defer rights according to convenience. If it's no longer convenient to follow human rights, they won't follow it. If it's no longer convenient not to torture, then they will torture or be complicit in torture. It's no longer convenient to protect civilians, or it's no longer convenient to observe the rights of other countries around the world who have oil resources that you want. Then they don't adhere to that. And religion is the one that restrains it. When I mean by religion, I don't mean only the Abrahamic faith, all worldviews, and I'm also going to include secular humanism as well as a religion, which I might add, the British Humanist Association claims charity as a religious organization in this country. So they actually benefit from the concessions given to religious organizations or organizations based on morality. It's the British Humanist Association. So I would say that if you look at a state that isn't governed by the idea, or it doesn't have stakeholders of a religion restraining that state, it's governed by other things, including, if it's not profits, it's profits. And what we see is, you do want to talk about unelected democracy? Well, why don't we talk about £1.9 billion spent by a corporate lobby industry of 14,000 individuals, all unelected, I might add, who dictate and who influence our politicians to do things according to the corporate bidding. What about that unelected group we don't really hear much mention of? And I would also say that the alternative is not to have one religion over all other religions. This is the false straw man. What you have in the House of Lords are politicians who are unelected, yes, but they don't have to worry about getting money for their election campaigns, to which they have to give favors to corporations in return for that money. They can act purely on their conscience, and they will not lose their positions, and they will not lose funding for their party or for their political future or campaign. And these people have been a check and balance against the capriciousness of corporate-funded democracy. So what I would say is that we can imagine Britain, and not just Britain, but any government around the world, to actually embrace a sort of pluralism. Pluralism where all religious and non-religious or morality or worldview stakeholders all contribute in restraining the materialistic vagaries of immoral and utilitarian government governed by corporate interests. Whether you are a secular humanist, whether you are a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew, I think everyone should have a say about restraining the vagaries of government, because it doesn't stop government from interfering in religion. In fact, the more secular a state gets, the more it will view itself as interfering in religion, as Thomas Hobbes mentioned when he first postulated the secular state, that sometimes the sovereign has to interfere in the religious doctrines of his people for good governments. So I will end on this point. I think that the purpose of religion, all religions, including secular humanism, should be not to impose their interpretation on people who don't follow their religion, no. But they should all have a say in mutually protecting each other and each other's rights to practice and believe in their religions as they see fit. And I will say that if you say that a state should or even can be completely separate from religion, it is as absurd as saying that a state can be completely separate from morality. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ahn, Lucy, and to all four of our panelists. It's now time for questions, so I hope you've all got lots of questions. Teresa, that will come around and give you a microphone. We'll start over there.
Could the panelists just briefly sort of comment on the current status? So the current balance of power between religion and state and their impressions of it as it is right now?
I mean, I think a principled view, namely that it shouldn't be what I've said it shouldn't be. It really depends on, at the moment, yes, there are some very, very good voices in the House of Lords, for example, who are able to say what they want to say, and they're able to inform and make decisions better. The fact is they could do all that outside of the House of Lords. There's no need for them to be in our Parliament.
I'm not sure if I understood the question. Is it referring specifically to this country?
I
think it's very strange because, not to sort of go into what other people have already said, but one of the things that just came up in the previous talk was that we have a secular government. We don't have a secular government at all, but we have a secular, largely secular society, but the government itself is still based on the idea of religion, right? If you just look at the coronation oath, for example, which is that God will look after the Queen, and it's the power of the crown that flows through Parliament, it's where the authority of Parliament comes from. The whole edifice is based on religion. And so David Cameron himself has said, you know, this is a Christian society, he thinks religion and politics shouldn't be separate. He had this whole idea, he doesn't have it now, of course, because it didn't go anywhere, but this whole idea of the big society, which was supposedly about getting religious groups involved in welfare services and giving them greater powers and influence and all this kind of thing. And it was essentially a double cross, right? So what they said was they were going to do this and then didn't give religious organisations the freedom or the money to do it, right? And, you know, from my perspective, a good thing that they didn't. But a lot of religious people were really angry with Cameron because he sort of betrayed them in a sense, made all these promises and then didn't follow through from it. So my take on the nature of religious power in this country is that the structures of government are still firmly based on religion, and the government finds it very convenient to try and use religion to get particular objectives through when it likes them.
Thank you very much. I think it's a brilliant question. I think that is where a good deal of our attention should be focused. Where are we today? You know, what is our assessment of the current balance of power in this particular country? I mean, I think one would say, you know, one wouldn't invent what we have now. You know, it has evolved in the way that all sorts of things have evolved in Britain to where we are today. Like all sorts of dimensions of British society, it has a certain oddness to it. And yet it seems to me to have a certain effectiveness to it. I think it is a pretty good balance. That's not to say that it needs to stay exactly as it is. I think it can continue to evolve. I think this debate is much more than about whether bishops ought to be in the House of Lords. I mean, I think you know that is a sort of subset of this particular question, and that I think is very much related to the whole question of well, what is the identity of the House of Lords, and is it appropriate to have people in the legislature who are not elected, and that argument, you know, if you say there's all you only want elected people, then that's going to involve a complete reform of the House of Lords, which may be the right thing to do. I think it does work. I mean, I think I'm reasonably comfortable with the way it works at the moment, even on that specific issue of the House of Lords. And the bishops do get themselves in a bit of trouble. I mean, because you're quite right. I think we do have to be very, very attentive to being manipulated in some form by government. And I think we avoid doing that. There's something to get ourselves in trouble. There's a bishop who spoke against the government and the chancellor recently, and was thought to be really speaking out of turn because this was a finance bill that had been the chancellor was supporting and the convention of the House of Lords. You just go along with that. But I think we need to look sort of beyond that, the House of Lords, and to look at this. The sort of weaving, as I've tried to describe it, of religious life into the fabric of the nation, and decide whether we think that is a helpful thing, or whether somehow we need to unweave it. And that's what worries me about this motion. I think it's simply a distraction to unweave it, and I think we will be left with a weaker society. That does not access the desire of religious people to contribute to the common good and to work with state institutions for that end.
I would say that just point to something very recent. So we know that the Conservative Party, David Cameron, has said that. We used to be a passive tolerant society, that if you remain within the law, we'd leave you alone. And in essence, he wants to change that. So if you no longer just stay within the law, they're not going to leave you alone anymore. And they want to now define this topic called extremism, which is a very scary word to use, because what is extreme? You know, one man's mainstream is another man's extreme, right? So we have to be very careful, but we have now silently accepted such, discussions and rhetoric. Now, I'm hoping that in the when this goes to vote, that there'll be conscientious people in the House of Commons, but primarily in the House of Lords, who would be maybe above the whip system, which is not an anti-democratic feature of the House of Commons. But I'm hoping that people in the House of Lords will oppose this motion in the name of justifying everyone's right to believe as they want to believe and not be imposed, silenced, or coerced into ideas or beliefs, or to criminalise for merely expressing difference of opinion or political dissent. And the issue is this: my colleague mentioned that we don't live in a secular government or secular country. But I'd say with this, because if the government doesn't open up a Bible and says, what does the Bible tell us to rule today? What law shall we make today from the Bible? But the government doesn't do that. What the government does is the same as pretty much every secular government does, which is they will use the rhetoric of the values and morals that they know the people hold to justify some purely secular idea according to whatever convenience or utilitarian calculus they have in their minds. Every single secular government in this entire planet has done so if their people happen to be of the religious persuasion, or they'll have a general, if in the case of China, probably, obviously, that might be a bit different. But now, and also USA, I mean, USA was built on a lot of immigrants who were basically of different Christian denominations, and of course, if you look at that dollar bill, is that a secular dollar bill, In God We Trust, or, One Nation Under God? If you look at if you want to read the Declaration of Independence, is that a very secular kind of thing to say, would you say? So, I mean, USA and the other Anglo-Saxon models of government are not purely secular, yes, but they're not purely religious either, and they maintain this balance which guarantees plurality. because everyone, every stakeholder, everyone's morality is represented in theory by the various politics, whether it's religious parties or whether you have a ecumenical state institution. So I'll just put it like this, you say, well, we should have these moralists who criticize the government and, you know, critically dissent from the government, but they don't need to be part of House of Lords. Well, I think they do need to be part of House of Lords, because if they're not, then who's going to oppose these very draconian bills that are going to be put through the government and imposed on people against their will in this country? We're going to rely on people of conscience to vote those bills out. Otherwise, if they go through, no amount of dissent or expressing your opinion on your blog is going to prevent the police knocking on your door for breach. And by the way, just so you don't know, the extremes of disruption orders will stop you even from blogging and accessing social media if the government deems you to be an extremist. So I hope there are people who are not swayed by the whip system and not swayed by the corporate lobbies who will vote out of their conscience to defeat such a bill, because they couldn't do so outside of Parliament. And I think just the last one, my final point is, when Europe discovered the Americas and was going to the Americas, the secular powers, the King of Spain, wanted to enslave the natives in the Americas and use them on plantations by force for economic reasons. The Catholic Church in the 15th century issued a papal bull saying that they're not allowed to enslave natives, even though it's very economically lucrative for them to use cheap labor. But the Catholic Church issued a papal bull, you know, saying that you're not allowed to do so. Of course, the King of Spain basically ignored that bull. The secular powers ignored that bull, and it proceeded ahead. Likewise, even in recent history, under World War II Germany, we saw that the Catholic Church actually rose out and criticized the Nazi Party, criticized for what they were doing. Thousands of Catholic clergymen were sentenced to concentration camps. So I think that we see that we need religion or any kind of moral system, whatever, but whether it's a materialistic moral system or a non-materialist moral system, we need these moral systems to be a restraint on government, because if not, then what else will restrain government?
Thank you very much. Lots of questions. Maybe we can go up there to the girl in the section.
This question is to Mr. Andalusi. I don't understand on what basis you say that religion prevents people from violating human rights. I find that extremely ironic, since the top countries, the worst top countries in regards to human rights, follow the Sharia law. Like, coming from the Middle East, I find it scary that I am not allowed to give my beliefs regarding religion, because I'm scared of either imprisonment or death, even, e.g. Saudi Arabia. So I find it extremely ironic to say that religion promotes human rights.
Well, this is a common misconception, actually, about the Middle East. You see, what you're seeing in the Middle East is not a group of countries governed by Sharia. I wish they were. What you're seeing is post-colonial creations by, the British Empire. All these regimes, mostly being client regimes, originally set up by Britain and obviously now dominated by the United States. I'll just give you one example. I've made a claim now. Let me back it up. So you say Saudi Arabia is governed by Sharia. Well, in the Quran it says, the Prophet Muhammad recited to Muslims, saying, the Quran it says, take notice of war from God and his messenger against those who deal with interest, or riba, because we view it as a great theft, interest, to basically, you're not transacting anything, but you're taking money from people unfairly, unjustly, and of course it leads to concentration of wealth and so on and so forth. Take notice of war for dealing in interest. Saudi Arabia has interest banking. So if the Quran declares war on anyone, when I say war, like a theological war, declares like a theological war, on anyone who does interest banking, and yet Saudi Arabia does interest banking, I think that should be just sufficient for me to show you just how un-Islamic Saudi Arabia is. And Saudi Arabia was one of the best British Empire allies during after World War I. And they used to be used by the British to bully all the other regional areas into British bidding. That's a different discussion. All the other countries are avowedly secular. countries like Bashar al-Assad, Syria, like President Sisi's Egypt, no Sharia law there. But if we want to go back into the past, we see a very different picture. Pre-colonialism, under the Ottoman Caliphate, we see that they had a millet system of religious pluralism. Every religious community were allowed to have their own autonomous ways of living, of worshipping, even their own police forces in many cases, and their own areas where they would literally just, they'll be left to deal the area any which way. The Ottomans didn't say to these people, you're living in ghettos, you should get out of these ghettos, you're living in your own communities, you should integrate and follow Ottoman values. No, they didn't say that. They said to each their own. We saw the Shia shrines in Iraq being funded by a Sunni caliphate, being supported and funded. We see the Patriarch of the Eastern Orthodox Church, which is like the Pope of the Eastern Orthodox Christianity, for those who don't know, was actually sponsored by the Ottoman Caliph, because many of the subjects of the Ottoman Caliphate were Eastern Orthodox Christians. So we saw a level of pluralism where these different groups, Jewish, Christian, others, they had their own law courts to govern their own affairs. No one said, look at these courts spreading halakha law or Christian law throughout our country. We should get rid of them. We should go on a march, as the EDL would say, right? You didn't see this. And I would argue you saw pluralism that doesn't exist even in the West. Because as soon as you even have voluntary arbitration courts from Muslim arbitration courts, there's a complete outrage and hoo-ha about it. How dare Muslims live according to their own belief? How dare they? They're imposing on us by living according to their own beliefs. So we're going to stop them in the name of freedom. And that is the situation. So I would say, if you look at Ottoman history, you have better religious pluralism back then even the West has in its own countries. And I would like the Muslim world to return back to that, because if you see the oldest churches in the Muslim world are in the Muslim world, and I'm very proud of that.
Thank you.
Forgive me, can I just say something? Are we not moving away from the debate? I respect you for the question you asked, but I think Mr. Al-Lusi, forgive me, opened up the question of Sharia law. This question is about this country. Yes? I don't think any of us want a history lesson. Absolutely right that you gave the history lesson, but I don't think anybody wants a history lesson. The focus surely must be on what religion is doing in this country, or could be doing in this country.
Well, anything that happened until yesterday is a history lesson, so...
And neither is it a debate on this House believes the new counter-extremism bill is wrong or not. I totally accept what Mr. Al-Ghanouzi is saying on the subject. The reality is we're getting far away from what we are here to discuss.
Yes, I agree. I think we should focus on the particular motion and this country. But may I just add one comment that I think is probably relevant to that question, and I think also relevant to our actual context here. And that's, I'm very struck by Nader Afzal's, I think, very profound comment: religion does not define my identity, but refines it. I think where national settlements get into trouble are where sort of citizenship, national identity, is defined by religious identity. I think that's where there are serious problems come about. And to be fair, we had that in our own land. So I think that's where, in other nations, the problem can come about. And you see that even emerging in, I think there are risks in India at the moment, that national identity by the BJP party is sort of seen to be somehow identified with Hindu identity. I mean, that's in a secular state. That's quite a worrying thing. I don't think we have that here by any means, that one's sort of loyalty to the state is defined by one's religious identity. But I do think that's a very fine way of putting it, that our religious identity is to refine us as human beings. And I guess that's an interesting area to consider. How far is religious identity refining people so that they can make a fuller and fairer and kinder contribution to the state and to common life?
Stephen, do you want to...
I can't remember what the question was, to be honest.
It was. I think it was about the countries in the Middle East being the worst human rights.
Yeah, I think the woman at the back put it perfectly well.
Okay, fair enough. We've got a question over there.
Hi, I study politics, and Stephen taught me last year Intro to Pol. And one of the basic principles of a democratic state is about electability. So one of the issues I have with the UK is that features such as the monarchy and the bishops in the House of Lords are essentially unelected. That's what it boils down to. We can't say that we live in a Western liberal democracy and champion freedom and civil liberties when we have this feature still in our government and still in our states enshrined in it. I do agree that it would be very difficult practically to separate the state and religion. However, if we do not even acknowledge the fact that it's undemocratic to have these features in the House of Commons, which is supposed to champion our views, then something is very, very wrong. So my question is, to those who oppose the bill, well, to anyone actually, to also answer, is that do you not think that it's undemocratic that we have the church and any sort of religion playing a part in politics today?
Let's talk about democracy. You know, the Athenians, if they looked at Britain today, they wouldn't say it's democratic. They'd say it was maybe elected oligarchy. They wouldn't say it's democratic at all. Because democracy means that people literally make the laws, that everyone, like every law is a referendum, and policy is decided by referendum. And in Athenian democracy, even judgments are decided by referendum in court cases. So they wouldn't view that Britain or America or any of the countries, maybe with perhaps Switzerland, maybe somewhere in between, as being any kind of democracy at all. In fact, they didn't even call themselves a democracy until the 19th century as a kind of rebrand, reappropriating the label, but it was very much more republican. And of course, as Edmund Burke himself said, it was because you don't elect people to represent your views, you elect them to think for you. This is what Edmund Burke said about the British system. And about, I think the same goes for all systems, really, because they couldn't trust the tyranny of the majority problem. What if the majority of people were governed by prejudice and they took the rights of the minority, or we can't allow that to happen. America has a constitution which is above any election, and certainly the electoral college system means that the people don't actually directly vote for which president. You vote for a particular side in your electoral college, and then that college will vote on your behalf. So the appeals to democracy sound nice, but if we want to really look at what democracy means, then we're not in any kind of democratic state. The real question is, how do we protect people's rights? And I would say that you can't eliminate that, even if you had everyone elected and there was no unelected person in government. They would still be dominated by lobbies who can supply them with the money they need for their election campaigns, where they can fund election campaigns that will get you to vote for them. Right, and sometimes the bigger, louder, more snazzy images, election campaigns work more than actual substance, which is the real issue. So you can't. There's a problem with you dealing with these kind of problems within the democratic system. And so what I'm saying is that, well, I'm not really saying anything. I'm really saying that look at what the people who formed these governments, the U.S. government, the governments of Europe, the governments of the U.K. did is they tried to have some system to moderate the tyranny of the majority problem, whereby they would have people who would, in essence, restrain the excesses of government in order to protect people's rights.
So do you therefore think that having people that are unelected in the House of Commons is wrong? So I do understand what you're talking about, lobbying. I totally agree. Like, yeah, it's awful. However, my question was, do you think having unelected people sitting in a democratic state, even though you disagree with what a democracy is, do you think that's a bad feature?
Well, I'll answer that with a counter question. Do you think that the people you elect... do you think the people that you elect are beholden to follow your views?
Of course not, but then after my question...
Then what's the point?
But my question to you, as someone sitting on the panel of this discussion, is that do you think that someone who is not elected should sit into the House of Commons? I totally understand what you...
Oh, in the House of Commons, sorry.
So bishops and people who are, like, the stages in, like, our democracy. I totally agree with what you say, echoing your sentiments about lobbying and about, you know, power being concentrated in the hands of the elite. I totally understand that. However, I just want that question to be answered.
Well,
Okay, in terms of the House of Lords, all I can say is that we have the system the way it is, and we haven't gone in the kind of extreme excesses that other secular states in this world have gone with more pure forms of democracy, complete elections. But all I will say is that if you can proffer a better political system which guarantees people's rights are protected and that the material interests of corporations are restrained, then I'm all ears. But until that point in time, we have to rely on people who are kind of outside the financial system in order to protect us from some of the kind of prejudiced interests of the financial system affecting our government.
Thank you.
Just very quickly, and the motion is of course more than this, but I think your question is a really good one, and we do have a rather sort of odd democratic culture. I guess an interesting question is, and I think in many ways you pointed to this, is does democracy need an element of undemocracy to defend it? I think that's quite an interesting question. It can be taken, there are all sorts of answers to it, but I think what we have at the moment is an elected House of Commons, and then we have another chamber which is not elected, which is seeking to, from a position of independence that that allows, scrutinise the activity of government. And we have a queen who is not, we have a head of state who is not elected. And that's a pretty odd thing as well, but yet it seems to work, because the queen seems to be able to, the monarchy seems to be able to create a safe space in which democracy can work and be exposed to it's a space in which there are certain checks on its proper operation. And yet it looks a bit crazy, and yet it does seem to work. I think your question about who do we want championing our views, well, that is absolutely right. And of course the House of Commons must champion the views of the people who have elected them. I think we just need to look at the evidence. Are members of the House of Lords championing the views of the people, or are they repressing the views of the people? And I think we just have to sort of test it by the evidence, in a sense. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nazir
or Stephen? I think we're going to
begin. Worse or not? Can I just step? We're talking about democracy in isolation. You all know it's democracy and the rule of law. So, in answer to the question, who protects your rights? The law. You can go to the Supreme Court. You can go to a High Court. You've seen it time and time again. They're overruling judicial decisions, overruling decisions made by government departments, by all manner of things, which is what you were able to do. And you have phenomenal organizations like Liberty and other organizations that will champion your rights. They're all there. There is no reason why we can't have a fully democratic parliament. Absolutely none. Our right to be championed in all sorts of places and by all sorts of people. And, I've worked at the center of the state, if that's the right word. I've been a state employee for 24.3 years. I stepped down 3 months ago. And I know how it operates. You can talk about the lobbyists, the cows come home. I know enough MPs who've got their own mind, who don't care where the money's coming from. We will not have a perfect system. We've got the best system that we can get in the circumstances. And that's the fact. The reality is, though, we can't have unelected individuals making legislation, making law. We can't have that.
Kind of got a bit of a soft spot for the House of Lords in a way, because I think any sort of chamber that can get somebody like Robert Winston in it, for example, can't be all bad, right? And so you wouldn't get those people in there if they have to stand for election and go through all the crap of party politics. On the other hand, my sentiments and my soft spot is vastly outweighed by my democratic leanings, and I completely agree, absolutely, I do, right? We should be completely democratic. Nobody, by the way, minds, this is an odd thing about secularists, they don't mind the idea of having bishops in the House of Lords. They really don't. The problem they have is bishops being in the House of Lords because they're bishops. If bishops want to stand for election and go to the House of Lords, then fine, right? That is the way it should work. Of course, we should be completely democratic and we should elect our own representatives.
Okay. Thank you. Wow, okay. We should go back to this side, maybe over there.
I just want to say thank you all for coming. My question is mainly addressed to the motion of the opposition, particularly what Ms. Andalusi said. Because you said if you remove religion, you make the state a religion. Although I disagree with you on that, but I also agree with everything you said about the lobbying and the current attitude of the British government. But then the second thing you said, you make the state a religion. But secularism isn't worshipping the state. And I feel like with that own statement, you kind of undermined your own argument, because you implied that because the state was now considered a religion, that was in itself a negative thing. And you cited these several supposedly secular governments. But if anyone who's ever looked at Nazi culture or Stalinist Russia or the Juche system under North Korea is aware that the very reason they're so successful is totalitarianisms. Is precisely because they operate like religions. They operate, to quote George Orwell, totalitarianism is by definition theocratic. So I'm interested to what the panel think about that.
Well, when I said about if you remove religion from state and state becomes a religion, what I'm saying is, what is the criteria for right and wrong? What we find is that usually all states will operate under following something higher than themselves if they are based on that, which is maybe secular liberalism or secular humanism, communism, or Christianity or Islam, throughout all these different variations throughout history. But when you detach that from the state and then the state becomes the decider of right and wrong, then it becomes de facto a religion. And then the state has to decide how to unite its members. It can't be united under any appeals to higher ideals or so on. So then it will unite under nationalism. Nationalism will come with the accoutrement of symbols, of rituals, of definitions. And then it takes on the form of religion. Now, what you're describing in terms of Stalinist Russia and so on, these are extreme examples. Not all religions totalitarian per se. But what we are seeing is that fascism doesn't have to look like Nazi Germany. It could look like Italy, for example, or it could look like Salazar's Portugal or Franco's Spain, for example, or in Mexico or Japan. They all felt
those fascist movements were essentially manifestations of the Catholic right at the time.
The Catholic Church had to fall into line in many of those governments, and they were viewed as almost subversives if they didn't go along with what the government has said. And this is the problem, is that the government would see religion as, in those situations, would see religion as subversive if it has anything to say about how people live their lives.
Sorry, we don't really have that much time.
I just want to speed up to your pertinent point, which is we heard one of the members of the proposition say that we have the best system here in the UK. And I say, well, that's the case, then why change it? Maybe it's the best system because of the balance that's been maintained. Okay, there can be tweaks, but why change it? And why do we feel that getting elected members of parliament would improve the quality of legislation? We say we have the rule of law. Yes, but the House of Commons can make that law, and they can change that law, and they, with a passing of a few pen strokes, they can remove your rights. Is that what you want to surrender your rights to, the capriciousness of a easily swayed, or could be easily swayed, House? So that's something, and it's so much so that the founding fathers of America didn't trust that system, and so they instituted the Constitution to give guarantees against the tyranny of the majority. And what we see now in current-day England is there's a mass prejudice incited by media, incited by the government, this rhetoric against certain minorities in this country, which are deemed to be threats. It's not the first time. In the time of Guy Fawkes, it was Catholicism that was viewed as a threat to the values of this country. And we see that the minorities were persecuted by the lawmakers who made laws against Catholics. So all I'm saying is that maybe we should, all I'm really saying is I think there should be something higher than the state, which is a set of values which cannot be compromised or contradicted by the vagaries of a of people, basically.
Thank you.
Guy Fawkes committed a crime. He wasn't persecuted for his beliefs. Can I say, I agree with you entirely. I think it's the easiest answer to say. Whatever system works around the world, whether you call it secular, and when you're talking about fascism, you didn't mention ISIS, by the way, did you? That's a fascist regime. When you have religion at the centre of the state, at governance, you will have all manner of human rights breaches. You will have everything that you've seen, you've talked about a moment ago, happening, because there is nothing there to check it. When you have democracy of the type that we have in this country, and thankfully in hundreds of other countries, you have something in place that will check it. You have you as people to stand up and say, we don't want the poll tax, or we don't want whatever it is. You can get involved in that conversation, but you can't get involved in a conversation where religion steers the debate.
I made the point that, actually, when we're talking about secularism, it's a bit tricky because there's no single form of secularism. Right? We speak about secularism as if it's just this one block thing, and it isn't. And the idea of secularism is really just state neutrality with respect to religion. But the idea of neutrality can be manifested in lots of different ways, right? So on the one hand, you have Indian secularism, which says that all religions should be allowed free to enter the public sphere. The Indian state will remain neutral as to how this plays itself out and will only interfere to the extent if one religion seems to be dominating the others. You then have secularism in the United States, which is the separation of church and state, and you then have secularism in places like Turkey and France, which are more authoritarian, perhaps. Now, when we talk about secularism, I think it's kind of incumbent on those of us who support secularism to admit that secularism is not perfect, and it's often used as a stick to kind of beat you with, that places like Russia and China are very authoritarian, they don't like religion and all the rest of it, right? And that's absolutely true, and that's not, I'm not saying it's supporting that, okay? I would argue in favour of a United States version of secularism, where there is this separation of church and state, and my point, to go back to my initial kind of presentation, is that this was actually good for both sides, right? It is good for citizens because they can't be imposed upon or oppressed in any particular way by religious groups. The reason why the United States is secular, by the way, is precisely because it was so religious in the first place, and religious groups were arguing amongst themselves and squabbling amongst themselves and were being oppressed by each other, and saw at the Jeffersonian Virginia settlement that it was in their interest to establish a secular state where the state wouldn't support any religion in doing this, right? So it's good for citizens, and it's also good for religion itself, because it stops the state from interfering in religion in the way that it does in places like perhaps Turkey and France and Russia and China and so on. So secularism is, in the United States version, and of course it's not perfect as well, right, is the best form of political organisation for freedom and equality across the board.
Only very briefly. Just on that, I think the fact is different nations have evolved different settlements, and I think the question is, well, you know, what works best in a particular cultural historical environment. I think what we have now works pretty well, really, and. I think an interesting question comparing us with the states is religious influence in the states sort of for the better than it is here, or is it by having a space within the organs of the state for a religious voice, does that actually help there to be a happier and more helpful religious contribution? I don't think I quite agree that without a religious involvement in the certainly in the legislature, that the state will become the religion. But I do think that there is a good history of religious people trying to check the role of the state, even if they're not within the state, when the state oversteps its part. And I think that is an important function of religion. And I suspect that is more difficult to do if you follow this motion of this sort of radical and complete separation of state and religion. Because as I'm wanting to say, and I think this is my sort of fundamental thesis, the state is more than the organ of national government.
Just a really quick comment, and then you're going to have to go to final statements, I'm afraid, because we're running out of time.
Just a very quick response to Nazir. Why I didn't mention ISIS as a regime, because I don't recognize them as a regime. They're just a bunch of thugs who go around in the Middle East. They're not a state. And they are all former secular Baathists from Saddam's regime who just rebranded themselves in the new guise. And they are the product of, unfortunately, our foreign policy there. But what I would say is that I would agree with my colleague here that, you know, look at France, it's a very secular state, and look how they treat their minorities. And they're European, they're not some far away in the Middle East or far away, you know, in the Far East. They're a European government, much more secular than us, and see how, we'll see their record of treating minorities. Now compared to England's treatment, and all I would say is that the motion today is the complete separation, very radical, complete separation of religion from state. I think that that's impossible. And I think even looking at the USA experience, people just repackage their religious motivations in the form of secular politics, but they are still driven by it. So that's what will be my point.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry, we can't have time for any more questions, actually. And we'll go to the final statements. Should we go in the same order as before? Is that okay? Can you start?
Okay, I mean, well, mine will be quick, because I don't actually have the
okay.
I will say one thing. So the argument in favour of secularism, as I've already said, and I'm not just going to stand here and repeat myself for the sake of it, right, is it's good for both sides in this equation. And we've heard one of the themes coming from the opposition side about this relationship between religion and morality. Only somebody who didn't know anything about religion and morality would say that religion and morality go together, because they don't go together at all, right? And I would just commend this to you, right? Go and look at work by Phil Zuckerman, okay? Z-U-C-K-E-R-M-A-N, Phil Zuckerman. He's the leading expert in this area. This is basically what he does, right? Gets up in the morning and this is it. And so he looks at the relationship between secularism and morality around the world, and one of his findings is, and no doubt if you know, you've read anything about this, you've come across this already, secular countries around the world tend to have higher levels of standard of living, higher levels of happiness, lower levels of crime, lower levels of juvenile delinquency, lower levels of family breakdown, all of the kinds of things that by proxy you would take to be an indication of morality, lower levels of violent crime, lower prison populations, all of these kinds of things, right? So if there's any kind of relationship between morality and states, it's the secular states that have it. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I certainly don't want to argue that you, in order to be moral, ethical, you have to be religious. I don't want to argue that. Nor do I want to argue that that you, in order to that if you feel that the House of Lords is not a good thing, and even if you feel that it is a good thing, but bishops shouldn't be there, then you know, let's argue about that, let's discuss that. But the motion is going further than that. Take me out of the House of Lords; it will give me a great deal more time. I won't worry too much about that at all. What do I do in my work with Coventry City Council and other councils around the
Coventry and around Warwickshire over trying to look after the homeless or trying to help the elderly who are dying of loneliness, or as we're trying to do at the moment, trying to reach out and provide refuge for the refugee. What am I to do with the hospitals? What am I to do with the prisons? What am I to do with the universities? Say, well, these state-funded institutions are not to have religious care to try to help and support them. And what am I to do with my parish priests up and down this area, who are plugged into communities and are not there just to serve the religious, not there certainly just to serve Anglicans, but are there because of the particular settlement that we have come to in this country, are there to serve every member of that community. I think we live in an increasingly religious age, and I think that the settlement that we have at the moment that allows some sort of interweaving of church, of religion and state, is a more profitable way for navigating religious difference than, for example, the example of France, where there's an attempt at a complete difference. So I think it's... I would commend you not to vote for this motion.
I'll stay here if you don't mind. I don't want reactionary secularism as you've got in France. I don't want pretend secularism as you have in India, where people can be killed for eating beef and there's very little judicial consequence. I don't want faith schools that discriminate on the grounds of faith rather than thinking about the outstanding talent they have in their place. My religion is between me and God, and it must not be between me and you. Thank you.
Lastly, Mr.
Andalusi. I think there's a few misconceptions. Religion doesn't mean only a person who believes in God. I'd argue we have a word in Arabic called deen, which means, I suppose, a way of life, a set of morals, principles, and it can refer to any particular belief system which guides you in your life. So everyone follows a religion, even if they are purely materialistic, and they are purely materialistic in their outlook. And your religion comes into play between you and everyone else, obviously, because if you're being a good person, you have to have a definition of what good is and how you derive good. And if you're a good person, I'd like to think that you're a good person because you believed it was a good thing to do, and not because you're just imitating society around you. Oh, everyone else is doing it, so I'll just do it. So every one of you who acts according to your conscience, based on your morals, is bringing your religion or your beliefs in between you and other people. And if not, then you're just social imitators. And I think all of us here would like to think of ourselves as people of conscience. If you look at the survey by Zuckerman, actually what you really see is how he categorizes states which are secular or not. And I think if you check that out, you'll see that states he doesn't consider to be secular are states which are ardently secular and have a poor quality of life. So I think we have to go and check his survey there. But I'll say this, and my point is this. I know everyone's brought this about the issue of England, England's situation, should we change England or not, but really it's actually not in the title. And the title doesn't say, should we have a separation of church and state, or should we have a deformalized connection between church and state. No, it really is a complete separation of religion from state. And the reason why I say it's pretty impossible, because even in a pure democracy, an Athenian democracy, people would still be informed by their morals, which derive from their worldview, and they would vote according to laws based on what they held. And in a pure democracy, you'd probably have more religion involved in state than the opposite. Now, all I'm really arguing is here today, I'm not arguing the how or what how to change UK or which kind of form of government. I'm purely saying that if we had a government where everyone is represented, it would not be less democratic, if it includes people's religious beliefs or moral systems or secular humanism or whatever, or Confucianism, whatever belief system you follow, if they were represented and where they were acted as a safeguard to protect everybody's rights, not to impose on people who don't follow that faith, but to protect those people who do believe in that faith. And so all I will say is this, that even in England, the British Humanist Association, for example, they advise government, they lobby government. The British Humanist Association, who have a moral system, a particular moral system not shared by everyone else, they lobby government on a number of issues. I'm not saying that's necessarily wrong, I'm saying that everyone does it. And I think everyone should be allowed to do it, and I'm saying that we should have a society where everyone's religions are represented and act as moral safeguards for the rights of each other. Thank you.
Thank you very much to all our panelists. We're going to have just a really quick vote. So who believes that this House would completely separate state and religion should pass? Okay. And who believes it doesn't, it shouldn't? Okay, so the motion passes. Thanks very much. Thanks again to all of our panelists. Thank you for coming, and we'll keep updating you around next week. Thank you.